I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Cannonball is part of the Agora Podcast Network. If you're interested in exploring other independent podcasts focusing on the rich realms of human knowledge, check out some of the other podcasts on the network like American Biography, The History of Alchemy, Beyond the Big Screen, Lands of Leviathan, and Tiny Vampires. And if you're an advertiser looking to reach an audience of discerning podcast listeners who are interested in the rich realms of human knowledge and think you might have a product or service that could advance those realms of knowledge, get in touch with us. We might could make something work. And while we've gallivanted out into the outer reaches of the realms of the shill, I'd like to put a plug in for the Cannonball's web presence. We do have a blog that's intermittently updating and which we'll be seeing a little bit more activity in the coming future. You can find us at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. You can also track us down on Facebook if you look for the group for the Cannonball Podcast. And one last thing. Daniel and I both guested on a couple of Agora podcasts last month. We popped by the Agora Exchange to explain what exactly we think we're doing here, and I did a piece for the annual Halloween show, Agoraphobia, on James Merrill's The Changing Light at Sandover, a 20th century American epic poem written with the help of a Ouija board. If you're not overly tired of our voices, check those out. Thanks, and hope you enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. My name is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me is Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Hey, very good. It's good to be back on the show. although I really enjoyed the last episode with an actual expert on the subject. Really great. I thought Matt was a terrific guest, but like I said, I'm glad to be back. Paternity still exists for me, of course. The baby's doing great, but it's a little less all hands on deck at the moment. We've sort of gotten into a bit of a more comfortable rhythm. So I'm back. I'm here. I even have a glass of red wine to get into the Frankish swing of things. Sadly, it is not a French wine. It is a varietal that came in a box called Redvolution. But it's pretty tasty. It's making me feel every inch the Francophile. I'm ready to talk about some classic French theater, man.
All right, cool. Well, what I thought we could do is begin by sort of summarizing each of the plays one by one, and then we could turn it back on itself. Mm-hmm. Let's do this like a parallel structure. We'll start off with a summary of The Misanthrope, then do a summary of Tartuffe, mm-hmm. and then analyze Tartuffe briefly and then go back into The Misanthrope. Because I think we both found The Misanthrope to be somewhat more complicated and discussion, well, I won't say worthy, but amenable?
Yeah, exactly. I love this. This will be our cloud atlas. just the my one cultural touchstone for that particular form of dramatic arrangement. But yeah, I like that. We tackle Molière through a bit of a creative structure here. I'm into it.
I was thinking Beckett's Watt and perhaps Bartok's Music for Strings, Percussion, and Celesta and The Golden Ratio, but we'll follow. No, I'm kidding. I'm just sometimes I feel like I have to play the part of the jerk.
That's okay. I feel like I have to play the part of the rube, and it comes together. You're not a jerk at all, Claude. Not at all.
Well, that's the thing.
You're someone
not
who knows
the
what they're talking about. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I feel like this is interchangeable in some ways. You know, someday when we're both 80 years old, we'll finally get to Pynchon's Mason and Dixon. And what those two cats find is that their opposites blend into each other and they both become parallels. And I think I'm much more the uneducated rube, in all honesty.
And I would call myself the pompous jerk in most situations. So it's good we can explore our own personalities through this funhouse mirror we call the cannonball. Hello again, everybody.
All right.
Are we starting the show again? Okay, anyway.
All right. So I'm going to try to read my own handwriting and see if I can walk us through The Misanthrope. Okay, so Act 1 begins with Alceste, who is our misanthrope, and he is too honest to exist in this world. He will not flatter anyone. He will not kowtow to social niceties, and he must tell everyone exactly what he thinks. So we open with him discussing with Philant his upcoming lawsuit. Now, Philant is the voice of reason. Philant is, I guess, a kind of stock character that we find again in Tartuffe, who is counseling that you have to take a middle way and, I guess, flatter some people some of the time and then be politely honest other parts of the time. Mm-hmm. Now, Alceste is in a lawsuit, the terms of which aren't quite clear, which I thought was kind of interesting. There are two lawsuits that actually occur in The Misanthrope. And the first one, which is sort of like this overarching lawsuit, is never exactly clarified. But anyway, it's an ongoing lawsuit.
It's a bit like it's the MacGuffin, where it's a plot device that it doesn't matter what it specifically is. It's there to affect the characters in a certain way. Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, and Alceste, I guess we can assume that in some way, shape, or form, he's being sued for libel, which in his case is probably more like some kind of truth-telling or inability to flatter. Okay, so Philant is advising sensible discretion, but Alceste says no. And Alceste is obsessed with truth at all costs. But he's madly in love with Salamine, and Salamine is a coquette. That's the word they use, or at least the word that Wilbur translates throughout the text. And she is sort of carrying on. We find out later she's carrying on multiple relationships by letter with several other people. So she's sort of stringing on several other characters in the text. And the strange part of this is that Alceste is madly in love with her, even though she is the antithesis of his own obsession with candor. Okay. So then Arant comes into the scene, and Arant is an acquaintance, and he arrives, and he wants praise for a sonnet, and Alceste won't give him praise. Arant leaves insulted, and Alceste stands his ground. Philant says to be polite, Alceste storms off, and Philant follows. That's the end of Act 1. Now, Act 2 picks up with Alceste encountering Salamine, but he can't get her alone. And we have a long scene of gossip where the major players and Salamine sort of come on and basically do an autopsy on the reputation of various people around town. Alcest is outraged.
That just felt like a kind of like every time I read one of those, you know, pithy takedowns of someone else who's not there in the room, I just heard boom, roasted after like every single.
Yeah, but I think that's what it's meant to do. And then Alcest is outraged, but several other characters, particularly Philant and Eliant, Selamine's honest cousin, point out that these are the exact same opinions that Alcest has. Mm-hmm. So Selamine is roasting people behind their backs, and Alcest is aggravated by that. But these are the same things that Alcest has been saying all along. Alcest says, well, at least mine is out in the open. He proclaims his love to Selamine by pointing out all of Selamine's faults. And then the whole thing is interrupted when Alcest is called to court. Orant is suing him for saying that his sonnet in the first act is no good.
Yes.
Okay. So, Act 3, while Alcest is at court, Selamine entertains friends and suitors. She also entertains Arsinoe, her friend, who, because she can't get a man, has turned prude. The two engage in a quick sort of verbal tete-a-tete. Alcest comes back, but Selamine leaves to write a letter, and Arsinoe implies that she has a thing for Alcest and a plan to expose Selamine. Act 4 opens with Philant telling Eliant about the dismissal of Orant's suit. Orant's suit is dismissed between the acts, and we never quite see it. We only get Philant's description of it, and apparently it was all very ridiculous. Orant forgave, and the rest went home. We get a discussion of Eliant's feelings for Alcest, as well as her desire to let things run their course between Alcest and Selamine. Philant confesses that he has feelings for Eliant and says that if Alcest won't have her, he would gladly offer his hand. Alcest enters and asks Eliant to marry him as revenge on Selamine. He found an incriminating letter, and Selamine enters and talks her way out of it. Then, another friend enters telling Alcest that he lost the original court case and must slip town. Okay. In Act 5, Alcest proclaims that he's had it and no longer has faith in human justice and is leaving society forever. Philant counsels detachment, but Alcest is too incensed. Orant enters, and both urge Selamine to pick one. Apparently, Orant has been courting Selamine on the sly, and now both of her would-be lovers are pushing her to say which one is it. Soon after, the whole cast is on stage, including two of Selamine's other would-be suitors, who have been given a more damning letter of Selamine's by Arsinoe. Selamine's playing all sides has come to light, and no one wants her, except for Alcest, who proposes they leave society together. She protests, he says enough, tells Eliant that he can't have any society, so Eliant and Philant begin their romance, and Alcest takes himself into exile, where he'll be free to be who he is. So that is the end of The Misanthrope. So next we have Tartuffe. And, okay, Matt was absolutely right in pointing out how Molière is drawing from the tradition of the Commedia dell'arte, because
100%. Yeah, that was extremely illuminating. I guess folks at home, Claude and I were talking before we started recording, and I usually, if I'm, you know, assigned a play or something, not that I've been assigned any reading, that's the wrong way to put it. If I'm reading a play, I usually like to find a recording of a performance, because that always like helps me, especially with, you know, less contemporary drama. It helps to sort of hear the emotional beats being acted out by actors. So after I listened to those, I went. It was only after I listened to those performances by I believe it was a project by LA Theater Works. They were absolutely tremendous Productions. I would highly recommend you seek them out. In fact, their production of Tartuffe included Star Trek The Next Generation's own Q, John DeLancey.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I believe he was playing Cléant, I believe. But anyway, point being, I went back after I listened to that. I listened to the episode with Matt. And the absolutely, like, hearing him sort of explain the stock plots of the Commedia dell'arte and the stock characters, it really opened up the understanding and interpretation of Tartuffe, because definitely of the two, Tartuffe is 100% more like the here's an adaptation of a story everyone has already heard before kind of thing. Except with a lot of, well, I guess we can, in your summary, we'll learn what got Molière in trouble for it.
Okay, so let me commence with my summary of Tartuffe. I feel like I'm 17 again. Okay.
Tartuffe is a land of contrasts. Thank you.
Okay, so we begin with Orgon's mother excoriating her grandchildren and daughter-in-law for not being as holy as Tartuffe. The whole household of Orgon's house. I can no longer excoriate my own students for being reductive. So the whole household sees Tartuffe as a fraud, but Orgon is taken in, so Tartuffe must stay. Cléant, playing the Philant role, offers wisdom and good advice on handling evil. He basically says we can't exterminate evil, but we can manage it as best we can. So Orgon enters, and we see how duped he is by Tartuffe's false piety. Cléant confronts him, and we find how Orgon we find out how Orgon took him in. Cléant tries to convince with reasoning and the nature of true piety, but Orgon won't have it, and Orgon reveals he's planning on having Tartuffe marry his daughter Marianne, despite her betrothal to Valère. Orgon tells his daughter, and she's stunned. Now, this is at the beginning of Act 2. Sorry, I should read my own notes more clearly, or I should write in a way in which a human could understand it. Sometimes I look at my script, and I imagine that I am trying to decipher the sort of ink blobs from the aliens in Arrival. Be that as it may. So, at the beginning of Act 2, Orgon tells his daughter that she's going to marry Tartuffe, and she's stunned. And we get this comic scene of Doreen, Marianne's maid, talking back to Orgon, sort of slyly undercutting him and undermining his power. When Orgon leaves, Doreen tells Marianne that she teases Marianne. She's sort of taunting her a little bit for capitulating to her father's wills, but then she helps her decide on a plan. They sort of work together to begin this plan to take down Tartuffe. Now, Valère enters for a brief tiff, but Doreen gets the lovers to make up and promises to help undermine Tartuffe, and they begin sort of working out some kind of plan. All right, so in Act 3, Doreen has connived to have Tartuffe and Elmire, Orgon's wife, alone together where Tartuffe can make a pass and Elmire can expose him. Dami, the son who's been hiding in the closet the whole time, bursts in and blows it all up. Orgon enters, and Dummy tattles on Tartuffe, but Orgon believes Tartuffe and not his wife or his son. Dummy is disowned and exiled, and Orgon moves forward with his plan to have his daughter marry Tartuffe and sort of put the whole house and all the finances in Tartuffe's hands. Okay, in Act 4, Cléant tries to reason with Tartuffe, but Tartuffe wants vengeance, and we can sort of talk about why that's significant. Tartuffe leaves, and Oregon enters with a contract for Marianne and the home and the wealth. Almir tries the seduction ruse with Tartuffe again, and this time she has Oregon hiding and watching. Tartuffe is exposed, but the house and its possessions now belong to him. The contract has been, ratified, so this whole plot was worth nothing. Furthermore, he has some incriminating papers and plans to use them. A friend of Orgon's, who in some way, shape, or form had been on the wrong side during a recent episode of Civil Strife, which perhaps you can speak more to, left Oregon with some of his papers, and Oregon sort of helped him get out of the way. Tartuffe has the evidence of that and is going to expose Oregon as a traitor. So, in Act 5, Oregon knows himself to be undone. He knows that this is all gone to hell. Cleant counsels stoicism, but Oregon despairs. All right, so Dummy and the family return to try to find a way out, but it's hopeless. The cops show up with a warrant for Oregon due to Tartuffe's release of the papers. And then Valere sneaks in and offers to help Oregon go into hiding. But at the last minute, the sheriff shows up with a warrant for Tartuffe from the king. He's a notorious fraud, and when he snitched on Oregon, the king recognized him and sent him to jail. The end.
Yeah, it really, the summary gets it all there, and what I think we should probably, at least to me, to kick off discussion a little bit, I just have to say that Molière did an excellent job of just making Tartuffe the most unctuous character I have ever read in my entire life. Any scene where he's like wheedling with Orgon, like when he's weaseling out of, having been, sort of the first attempt to expose him as a lech, goes awry with Dummy, coming out and him just pleading his case to Orgon is you just want to slap the hell out of that guy.
Coming back to the Groucho Marx line. Well, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?
Right, exactly. But yeah, I think, I think in terms of character, the misanthrope and the characters in it are sort of more fully drawn. The characters in Tartuffe are a little more stock, but yeah. I was deeply impressed with Molière being able to draw out just the kind of overpious unctuousness at the heart of the criminal hypocrisy at work with Tartuffe.
I think the best way to take this on is we both really sort of found the misanthrope to be richer in or more complicated in a way. Mm-hmm. So let's breeze through Tartuffe and then jump back into the misanthrope. Because I think you're absolutely right that this is something closer to stock characters and kind of a stock plot. What struck me was the way that it veers really so far towards coming undone. Mm-hmm. Like the evil that Tartuffe does isn't just a benign, well, not benign, a sort of banal, malign, right, con job. The play really does veer close to tragedy.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's up to the king to sort of unravel it. And I'd read it back in high school, and it was just like, when you're 16 and 17, you want to say, well, all these Jesus people, they're like not really doing it, not a bunch of hypocrites, and they just want my weed. But there's much more to it.
Yeah.
In that, okay, one more time, it really could go horribly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And that sense of real loss and the bad guy, a very bad guy, really winning by the end is palpable there.
Yeah, like so, when the play opens, you or at least for me, like when I was, you know, when I first you know read and listened, it leads off. You think the stakes are going to be just, you know, the stakes are that this guy Orgone is going to be so deeply embarrassed when it comes out just what a heel Tartuffe is, and you think that's what the stakes are going to be for the or like, you know, that he's that Tartuffe or like, you know, Tartuffe is going to marry the daughter or something.
Yeah,
you know, that's yeah. like, and that's serious and that's bad, but you think that's going to be the stakes. But yeah, it just the stakes ramp up to the complete ruin of the lives of like 6-7 people in one fell swoop by this, you know, horrible manipulating cad. And you're right, like it goes and it cuts it very close and is only saved by a almost literal Deus Ex Machina ending, where the only way the thing is resolved isn't even through any sort of agency of the people afflicted, but it's rather because the king heard about it. And
yeah.
This is interesting to me because it ties into, you mentioned kind of some of the leverage that Tartuffe had on Orgone, is that Orgone was holding on to some documents for his friend Arga, who had been on the wrong side of a civil war against Louis XIV, who was the audience for this play. We have to remember, Molière was writing, and this play was performed for a courtly audience that included the king, Louis XIV. But so what was this this upset? Well, this would have been about, 15 or so years? Yeah, about 15 years before Tartuffe was written. And it was pretty early on in Louis XIV's reign, or at least, I mean, he'd been reigning as the titular king since he was a child, but this would have been sort of early on in his sort of getting his sea legs as a monarch. And it was a sort of series of revolts and resistances called the Fronde. And they kicked off around the same time that the Thirty Years' War ended. So this would have been around 1648. And anytime you have a bunch of hard-bitten veteran soldiers who are all of a sudden unemployed, you're guaranteed all kinds of mass unrest. Throw in some royal uncles who are upset about their prerogatives being a bit amended, and you have a real powder keg situation. So what the Fronde was, what these sort of resistances were basically kind of the last... It was kind of the last ditch effort by the great nobility to retain their accustomed liberties and sort of their accustomed license in the face of an increasingly centralizing absolutist conception of monarchy. The thing to understand about absolute monarchy is that it's not... You know, the political progression doesn't go from absolute despotism to loosening up a little bit so nobles have more freedom to loosening up even more so that rich people in general have more freedom to loosening up in the French Revolution or whatever. Like, the absolute monarchy was a deliberate response. It was a deliberate policy decision on the part of the court of Louis XIV in particular, and, you know, and sort of the intellectual foment of the time. It was all about, it was sort of this proto-Enlightenment project of rationalizing almost, centralizing and rationalizing and hardening control. So the Fronde, this thing that was a sort of last ditch effort on the part of the nobility against that, that absolutist monarchy, is what got Orgone's friend in trouble. And what comes to the rescue in the play Tartuffe? The absolute authority of the king. The absolutist ability of this monarch who rules by will alone and not hemmed in by any traditional prerogatives that other people and other nobles or what have you might have. He can go in and abrogate this contract out of nowhere just by his own absolute authority.
So ultimate justice comes down to the primary authority, and in this weird move, it's a justification for the prerogative of the king and a justification for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
That the king is the ultimate one who can make the ultimate forgiveness.
Right. And it's a little bit ironic also that it was through the chaos and the destruction that the Fronde inaugurated in France that basically everyone just threw up their hands and were like, well, look, anything, fine. Like, we need someone to take the helm. Let's invest all this power in the absolute monarchy so this doesn't happen again. So they really shot themselves in the foot. But that's what I thought was, it was pretty interesting of in Tartuffe that, like, the play itself, the way it's resolved, is almost a bit of absolutist monarchist propaganda.
Yeah. Because Cléante is arguing the whole time for a particular model of Christian forgiveness, mm-hmm. and acceptance of the faults of others, arguing that you should focus on mending your own faults. Mm-hmm. And then Molière allows the king to do just that at the end of the play.
Yeah.
So he's exercising his absolute authority, not through punishment, but through mercy.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly right. Absolutism need not mean, you know, it's absolutism with velvet glove, isn't it? I mean, that was like Louis XIV's whole shtick, for lack of a better word. But it is interesting that, you know, Tartuffe, for all of the sucking up that it does to the secular authority, really got Molière in hot water with the church. And that's what made it the sort of the controversial play that it was, because Tartuffe and I think it's one of those amazing sort of backfiring moments where the character of Tartuffe in the play, it's great pains are made. Like Cléant, for instance, has these entire monologues about how true piety is the greatest treasure mankind can have. You know, true piety is truly, like, you know, it's super great to be Orthodox and Catholic, and that's what you want to be.
Well, yeah, if I can intervene with some of his speeches at least 189 of my text, it's Act 1, Scene 5. He says, so I've been told before by dupes like you, being blind, you'd have all others blind as well. The clear-eyed man you call an infidel, and he who sees through humbug and pretense is charged by you with one of reverence. Spare me your warnings, brother. I have no fear of speaking out for you in heaven to hear. Against affected zeal and pious knavery, there's true and false piety as in bravery, and just as those whose courage shines the most in battle are the least inclined to boast, so those whose hearts are truly pure and lowly don't make a flashy show of being holy. And then there's another scene it's when Cléante is talking with Tartuffe about the nature of forgiveness. This is Act 4, Scene 1. He's talking to Tartuffe about forgiving Dummy and allowing Dummy back in the household and trying to work a kind of detente between Dummy and Orgon. He says, ought not a Christian to forgive, and ought he not to stifle every vengeful thought? Should you stand by and watch a father make his only son an exile for your sake? Again, I tell you frankly, be advised, the whole town, high and low, is scandalized. This quarrel must be mended, and my advice is not to push matters to a further crisis. No, sacrifice your wrath to God above, and help Dummy regain his father's love. And then Tartuffe says, alas, for my part, I should take great joy in doing so. I've nothing against the boy. I pardon all. I harbor no resentment. To serve him would afford me much contentment. But heaven's interest will not have it so. If he comes back, then I shall have to go. After his conduct so extreme, so vicious, our further intercourse would look suspicious. God knows what people would think. Why, they'd describe my goodness to him as a sort of bribe. They'd say that out of guilt I made pretense of loving kindness and benevolence, that fearing my accuser's tongue I strove to buy his silence with a show of love. Okay, so this sort of gets at what you're talking about. What Cléante is counseling is revenge really the Christian thing to do? Right. I think maybe we discussed it either on air or off air about Dante and this idea of vengeance. Mm-hmm. If you're taking revenge, you're taking justice out of God's hands and right, putting it in your own.
Right. You're basically saying you do not trust God to make things right. You don't trust the justice of God. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly what Cleont is saying. And Tartuffe says, yes, I agree, but heaven's interest will not have it so. There's this way in which Tartuffe intervenes to say, well, I know what heaven wants, and they want me not to forgive him. And anyway, I would look like an idiot.
Right. What would people say if I show myself to be magnanimous? They'd think I'm a simp, you know?
Yeah, and so there's this back and forth between, you know, what I thought was very interesting was this idea, or at least the broad idea of Reformation Christianity versus good old Catholicism, is that Reformation Christianity or Protestantism is more concerned with the internal truth or the internalization or some kind of absolute truth outside from the activity. You might look one way, but really be another way. And Catholicism is obsessed with ritual and the external aspect. But this gets at some of those complications.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, God says, yeah, go ahead. That's good. But I'd look like an idiot. I mean, really.
Yeah, it's a very and it sort of gets to the heart of, you know, Tartuffe's odiousness also, like this kind of like,
yeah.
he only thinks in terms of these calculations.
Would God want me to look like an idiot? Would God want me to look like?
Would God want me, a pious man, to look like an idiot?
Yeah.
Like,
I just thought that was funny.
Absolutely. Yeah. It comes at a kind of an interesting time, and again, sort of tying into some of these, I guess, why the Catholic Church was so sensitive to mockery, or at least to the idea, why they were so ready to believe they were being mocked, I guess, in France at this time, is that it was a very insecure time for the Church. And not only, I mean, there were certain frictions with, of course, the ballooning of secular power under the absolutist monarchy, but also this was, of course, the 30 Years' War had wrapped up in 1648, a catastrophic war driven in part because of the divide between Protestant and Catholic, you know, polities and peoples on the continent. And, you know, there were Protestants in France. Surely this is some sort of fifth column. These are the Huguenots, the French Calvinists. And we all, what I thought was kind of interesting that I learned a little bit more about as I was doing a little more sort of background research for this episode, that pretty much everyone, like, one of the things that you remember about your unit in high school on Louis XIV, the Sun King, is the Edict of Nantes, the Edict of Toleration of Protestants in the Kingdom of France, which I believe was in the 1630s or 1620s. It was earlier on in the century. What is less famous is when that toleration was revoked about 70 years later, and they were literal, like, pogroms to drive the Huguenots out of France. There were about around, you know, up to maybe a million people, you know, in estimations, but, you know, several hundred thousand at least, who were these sort of French Calvinists, these Huguenots. And about a decade after that toleration was revoked, there were maybe 1,000 to 1,500 practicing Huguenots left within the territory of the Kingdom of France, because there were literal, like, bands of soldiers would go and kick people out of their homes and just make life hell for anyone who was a Huguenot. But it's in this sort of, I imagine there must have been a bit of a frisson in the decades between decades of toleration, where the Church is just suspiciously eyeing down everyone who deviates from any kind of absolute and unquestioning devotion to the Church. And here comes Molière buddying up to Louis XIV, who's already kind of like chafing some of the great landowning bishops, you know, the wrong way by horning in on their traditional liberties. He comes up with this play where an outwardly pious man is actually this horrible, wicked villain. And so no matter that the play is all about how true, you know, we should be on the lookout for hypocrites and, you know, and they're bad. And he has this character and he has a character who literally talks about how great it is to be an Orthodox Catholic and they're the best people in the world. Yeah, Molière got into some really, really hot water with it, apparently. apparently the very original version of this, Molière got so spooked by the reception he got for it that he rewrote it extensively. So apparently we only have the rewrite, mm-hmm. if I recall correctly, which might go a long way toward explaining why there's a character who goes way out of his way to talk about how great the church is.
I mean, that seems to get at this weird, okay, you capitulate to royal power and you're screwed by the church. Mm-hmm. You cozy up to the church, you're screwed by the royal power.
Yeah.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't. Let that be a lesson to whoever's trying to cozy up to what.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I thought was really kind of fascinating about Tartuffe is how much of this is about control of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Bloom in some of his writing is really up on Iago as a master of perspective, and I see what he means. If you read Othello, Iago controls every scene. He controls how we see the characters, and he doesn't control how we see the characters. He controls how the characters on the stage see the characters, and he controls how they understand the information that they get. There's an important distinction to be made between the information and the interpretation of the information.
Mm-hmm.
You with me? That there's this discrepancy. We get so-called the cold hard facts, but there's a framework for the cold hard facts that we must, that allows us to read the facts in a certain way. In both Tartuffe and The Misanthrope, that perspective or that control of perspective is there in a couple of characters, and it has to do with justice. In this weird way, Tartuffe is controlling how other people interpret justice. Because he has the contracts at the end, he has the information at the end, he has this kind of leverage at the end. And that allows him to essentially get what he wants.
Yeah.
There's this real question, or I guess this cycles back to what we were talking about, having an absolute authority. Without that absolute authority, the play seems to argue, justice is simply a matter of perception.
Yeah.
Whoever has the most pieces on the board, or whoever can manipulate the pieces to the best of his advantage, is the one who gets justice, and all others are without hope. Now, in Tartuffe, that is resolved through the figure of the king. But what was fascinating about The Misanthrope is that it's not resolved.
It's really not. Yeah. 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 This is what a great segue into talking about the other play that we have to talk about.
Thank you. It's almost as if I have notes that I could read.
I mean, it's amazing. But no, you're absolutely right. Like I was a little bit surprised that the, I honestly expected that I thought that maybe like, cause I'd listened to the play and I thought to myself like, well, is the file incomplete or something? Like, did the library screw this up? Because the play ends so abruptly. It ends with, it ends with Alceste, marching off saying like, he's fed up with this world. He's heading off. And then, and Philant saying like, oh, well, let's go after him and see if we can convince him to stay. But that's the end of the play. It doesn't resolve with them like actually convincing Alceste to do anything. It doesn't. It's just him like all of his worst suspicions about humanity are basically confirmed. He's had it up to here and he's out. But yeah, Alceste is a really fascinating character. I think this he is, of course, well, I presume he is the titular misanthrope. I guess he must be. He's the most misanthropic of all the characters. It's a very interesting character because we've all had those moments where we're sick to death of like at work, you know, or something where you're I don't know who else is out there, but I work at I work in a very public facing way. You know, I interact with the public all day as my job. And you do have to you have to bear up and be, you have to bear up and not be as honest as you might want to be a lot of the time. it's more widely applicable, of course, in society, you know, in every aspect of society, of course. And we've all had those moments where we're just thinking like, boy, if I could just tell off everyone, you know, and just really what I want to think. But of course, as we all know, that we also have our inner philant there to tell us like, now, wait a minute, guy, that might sound good, but, you know, there will be consequences to that.
Yeah. And that's the nature of, well, let's all wax Freudian for 5 seconds, but that's the nature of being social, mm-hmm. that you have to put aside certain aspects of your own wants and desires. You have to put aside certain things that you would say or could say. You have to sublimate some of those desires in order to get along with others.
Right.
And that's called maturity.
Right, right. Yeah, is that Alceste is like that, you know, he's like the sulky 16-year-old who's going around saying like, you're all a bunch of phonies. You're all phonies. Yeah, you're all fake friends. He's one of those viral Facebook fake friends posts.
But there's something else going on here, because there's a real question about, or it's a real question that I think is lurking within the play itself about who is the real you? What is the real me? And
right.
Alceste seems to be on. He claims to know who and what he is, though that is paradoxical. There's this lurking question about why he's so madly in love with Selamine, and there's this continual discourse about how he's being forced to love her. It's his fate to love her.
Right, I can't help but love her.
He can't get out of it in some way.
Yeah.
And that would seem to go against this idea that he really knows who and what he is and what he really wants.
Well, and I think there's, I guess just as a point of like, Alceste maybe not being as completely integral as he thinks. I don't know what the word is to say full of integrity. But that was what really jumped out to me was very early on. It's when Orant comes to deliver his sonnet. And he asks Alceste, what do you think of my sonnet? And Alceste, at first, he is very roundabout. He's very circumspect.
Yes.
And it seems to go against everything he was just saying with Philand about how he needed to be blunt and honest. Because the way he starts about it is like, this is Alceste responding to Orant. He says, sir, Orant says, don't shrink from telling me sincerely what you think. And Alceste says, sir, these are delicate matters. We all desire to be told that we've the true poetic fire. But once, to one whose name I shall not mention, I said, regarding some verse of his invention, that gentlemen should rigorously control that itch to write which so often afflicts the soul. He continues from there, but he couches all this by saying, now I was telling this friend I have that maybe he's not so good at writing poems.
Well, that was an interesting part, is that for all of Alceste's bluster at the very beginning, he is very want to be roundabout, politic, and polite in the initial go. And it almost seems as if Orant provokes him into basically saying, your poem is terrible.
Right.
There's this weird way. But I think you're absolutely right that for all of the expectation we've been given that we've been given that he's about ready to blow, he is willing to work in the politic vein. It just comes to nothing. There's this way in which he always reminds me of, or at least this time through, he reminded me of, I keep going back to the Marx Brothers, Groucho Marx and Horse Feathers, whatever it is, I'm against it. Right. That the kernel of his being seems to be to be against whatever it is. And if somebody came out and said, that's a great idea, we must go into exile,
right,
we must leave society forever, it seems as if Alcest's reaction would be, that's a stupid idea. You're doing it all wrong.
Look, we have a society right here, and all we need to do, like, it's kind of a, almost like the, he does seem sort of beholden to this kind of idealism, almost, that if only everyone were totally frank and honest with one another, our society would actually work the way it's supposed to. He seems to believe at first, and then, of course, he sort of abandons that, but...
Well, I mean, I was even going into this. I'm not entirely certain how to frame this or what conclusion I could come to. But he goes into this weird place. Matt was bringing up the meta-theatrical aspects of the play. Mm-hmm. And talking further with Matt off air, one of the things that he was pointing to was this way that you can never quite know the real Molière. You can never quite know the real real. And I think this was something he brought up in the interview. Mm-hmm. You can never... Molière famously wore a mustache as an actor in all of his plays, except The Misanthrope, which was taken to be a signifier that he was telling the truth or being the real Molière, but the real Molière is playing a part.
Right.
There's this question here about what the real is.
Right.
So his very being, Alcest's very being, is to contradict others. And so his desire is to leave society forever where he can be left alone to be himself. Mm-hmm. But the very nature of his being is to contradict others.
Right. What self do you have left when there isn't? Yeah. When there isn't that you're there as a foil to the, or you see yourself as a foil. You've built this, what you see as a strong identity in opposition to the going mores of your time. And it comes, it's very interesting that it's so often couched in Alcest's sort of diatribes about this as being these days or in this time, in our times. And, you know, whether that has something to do with the kind of that burgeoning court culture that Louis XIV is sowing. And, of course, anytime you have court culture, you have, you know, by its very nature, that lends itself toward all manner of sort of disguised intents and miniature conspiracies and flattery and you know, what have you, just because of the way that those kinds of court societies operate, and the fact that it was so influential on the rest of society by this point, you know, this kind of the manners of the court were filtering out to at least, you know, the upper bourgeois, we might say, that which I think all of these characters belong to. I mean, I guess, yeah, we can place them in their classes. Like the fact that anyone is going out and bringing lawsuit against someone else over a sonnet positions these people as having a lot of time on their hands, I think.
Sure.
but they're not nobles, you know, but that, yeah. So the sort of cult culture has seeped into it. And that's, Alcest sees himself as, I would see, perhaps Alcest sees himself as fighting for those bourgeois values of probity and honesty against the corrupting influence of aristocracy.
But it can't exist without the corrupting influences,
right,
of aristocracy.
You can't be that man without it. Yeah.
It's sort of like, if you think about to move forward a couple hundred years into French culture, the aesthetic avant-garde was setting itself absolutely up against the sort of bourgeois hedonism, though the aesthetic avant-garde could not have existed without the bourgeois hedonism in order to set itself up against.
Right.
And the bourgeois hedonism absolutely needed the aesthetic avant-garde to justify its own existence because it kept buying it. In Baudelaire's Fleur du Mal, the very first poem to the reader is essentially, hey, I'm this horrible, hideous, terrible human being who experienced all this and wrote it, but you bought the damn book.
So, right.
I mean, Okay, that's a couple hundred years in the future, but that root seems to be back here. There's this tension that cannot be resolved, and you really, really sort of wonder. Alcest needs Flamont and Eliant to come drag him back, because his very raison d'etre is to be antisocial, and he can't be antisocial outside of society. So it's sort of like everyone needs each other, and it cannot be resolved, and they must keep fighting until the end. Otherwise, they collapse into nothingness.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's Alcest's, you know, a final goal. He's attempting to achieve moksha. He's achieving the enlightenment, the annihilation of self by removing himself from that which sustains him. Who can say?
But that's the weird thing about this play, and this is sort of what we said, is that it's bizarrely unresolved. Mm-hmm. And no perspective seems adequate. Mm-hmm. In Tartuffe, we had Cleant as the sort of capitulation to Catholicism, whether Catholicism wanted to acknowledge it or not, and to the authority of the king, who probably did acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. But in The Misanthrope, we don't have a clear perspective that we can say, aha, this is the one that does it. Flamont would appear to be the one. He's the one who's sort of counseling reason and, you know, just going along with things for as much as he possibly can. On page 23 of the Wilbur translation, he has this sort of peon to, hey, just acknowledge society's faults. He says, come, let's forget the follies of the times and pardon mankind for its petty crimes. Let's have an end of rantings and of railings and show some leniency towards human failings. This world requires a pliant rectitude. Too stern a virtue makes one stiff and rude. Good sense views all extremes with detestation and bids us be noble in moderation. And then further on, he says, I take men as they are, or let them be, and teach my soul to bear their frailty. And whether in court or town, whatever the scene, my phlegm's as philosophic as your spleen. Mm-hmm. Nothing seems to bother him. He's okay, stoicism, let's be detached, let's be removed. Mm-hmm. But that, I think, is called into question later on, when he's talking to Eliant, he's talking to Eliant, who is the cousin of Salamine and the would-be suitor of Alcest, and he's saying that essentially, well, okay, she says on page 105 of the Wilbur translation, Sir, I believe in, Eliant says, Sir, I believe in frankness, and I'm inclined in matters of the heart to speak my mind. I don't oppose his love for her, Alcest's love for Salamine. Indeed, I hope with all my heart that he'll succeed, and were it in my power, I'd rejoice in giving him the lady of his choice. But if, as happens frequently enough in love affairs, he meets with a rebuff, if Salamine should grant some rival suit, I'd gladly play the role of substitute, nor would his tender speeches please me less because they'd once been made without success. And then Flamont says, well, madam, as for me, I don't oppose your hopes in this affair, and heaven knows that in my conversations with the man, I plead your case as often as I can. But if those two should marry, and so remove all chance that he will offer you his love, then I'll declare my own, and hope to see your gracious favor pass from him to me. In short, should you be cheated of Alcest, I'd be most happy to be second best. Okay, on the one hand, this is, okay, as a near 40-year-old, or by the time this runs, probably a 40-year-old, this seems to me logical, reasonable, rational, and sane. Mm-hmm. If I were to counsel one of my young students, I'd say, well, life is long, you love much, you will find other people, so on and so forth. But in the moment, this is more or less Flamont's proposal. Mm-hmm. Is this not cold-blooded? there seems something really lacking in the romance between Eliant and Fallant, which we're made to believe is the most reasonable, rational, and sane one. And it's basically a sort of, well, let's work out the details. Let's treat this like a mathematical equation. If this doesn't work out right for this, and if this equation does not work out here, then perhaps we can combine these two variables and we'll have a pleasant conclusion. there's something a little icy about it that I think we're meant to see.
And that now that you're explaining it that way, this really contrasts very starkly with Alceste and his relationship with Célimène. And that you would think, so Fallant makes Fallant's out there making an argument and saying to Alceste, like, you know, you're being too rigid and too logical. You need to make room in your heart for human folly. And yet the person who's accused of being too rigid and too logical is the one most beholden to this utter senseless love for Célimène that is easily the most emotion that's shown by any of these characters is his sort of fraught struggle with himself over his feelings that he has for Célimène. And here we have Fallant, the fellow that you might presume to be like, well, he says to make a little space in your heart for folly. And yet he's so philosophic about his folly that what folly does he actually have in his life? Not very much at all, you know, and I guess perhaps that's the ultimate sort of irony of this kind of neo-stoicism that's, you know, accept the world as it is for all its faults. And yet you take yourself so outside of it that you do you even partake in it? You know, you stand so outside of it.
Now, I have much more ammunition, but I think it might be time to take a quick break from the sponsors. And we'll come back to this, and I'll keep making my case that The Misanthrope is a play that seems to have this kind of missing center.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ah, what a lovely product and or service. Now, I think one of the other things to get into is whether or not Célimène has a case. Alkest is sort of critiquing her. Well, not sort of critiquing. He is critiquing her for all of her flirtatiousness and for keeping all of these men around. And she claims different reasons at different points, and they might actually be sane reasons. Mm-hmm. On 56, or on 55 and 56, this is Act 2, Scene 3, Alkest is claiming that one of her friends is just an absolute bore and obnoxious. He's a gossip. And Alkest says, if he's a pest, why bother with him then? And she says, heavens, one can't antagonize such men. Why, they're the chartered gossips of the court and have a say in things of every sort. One must receive them and be full of charm. They're no great help, but they can do you harm. And though your influence be ever so great, they're hardly the best people to alienate. One of the things going in this court culture is the fact that so many people can undermine you or really hurt your case, literally, because she has another law case.
Right.
It seems like everyone is being sued.
It made me very curious about jurisprudence and the court system during the reign of Louis XIV. But sadly, I was not able to do a lot of research in that regard.
But yeah, so that's one thing that's sort of going on is you can't piss off certain people. Like there are certain people that right. you can't, you know, you have to sort of keep them around. You have to keep them pleased. Otherwise, they could really hurt you. And then some people you just keep around because they really can help you. They're not fun, but they can do you some good. She's sort of giving her riposte to Alkest at Act 2, Scene 1, you're much mistaken to resent him so. Why I put up with him, you surely know. My lawsuit's very, very shortly to be tried, and I must have his influence on my side. One of the things going on throughout The Misanthrope is all of these lawsuits are not really determined so much by the actual facts of the case as to how you can sort of grease the wheels. Or influence people, or politicize your case so that more people believe you than not, so on and so forth. Justice is not a system. Well, okay, if it is a system, it's a system of perception, which is what I was getting at with Tartuffe. Tartuffe can control perception. The other characters in The Misanthrope are very interested in controlling the perception or keeping people around who can help them control perception so that they can get quote-unquote justice should the need arise. Mm-hmm. Even Philant is arguing with Alkest, hey, you gotta work the system. If you don't work the system, you're going to lose the case. And Alkest says, no, I want absolute justice. And right. Philant is saying, well, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, he wants to win his case by merits. And you know, Philant is just desperately trying, like, guy, you got to understand where you live. This is the court of the Sun King we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially it.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, Selamine is a flirt and she's keeping all these people around. On the other hand, she kind of has a point. On the one hand, Philant is reasonable and rational. On the other hand, he's a little too reasonable and rational. None of this stuff absolutely works out. On the one hand, Selamine is going behind everybody's back to be a total gossip. On the other hand, these are the exact same things that Alkest has been saying about everybody the whole way through. So how do we resolve this? The play sort of seems to suggest that none of this is really resolvable. The only resolution is to go into self-exile and then have your friends drag you back.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think I'm coming around, Claude. I think you have a very well thought out case for the, well, I think the very sort of open And the irresolved end of the misanthrope points to the fact that there, yeah, it's, it has no missing center. There's no way to resolve it because no one has the right answer to any of this. And we're all just stuck, you know. Well, I guess, yeah, in the chat we were talking about, and you said that I put this well, that that the driving force of conflict in the misanthrope is this interiority that all these characters have, and that the play itself is their various interior lives crashing into or rubbing up against each other in ways that they can, in ways that go, this, their interior lives, their interiority crashing into each other in ways that they were not expecting to have them go. And this we have, like, sort of when Célimène is confronted by both Orant and Alceste, or is it Acast and Alceste? I think it's Acast and Alceste, who are left, and like, then they're both there saying, look, we're both here, just say, I really love you or you, so we can all be done with this. And she can't do it. she just can't bring herself to do it. And that's all of them. Like, they're all playing these, they all have these interior lives, and they're very carefully choreographing their exterior lives. And here, and in so doing, they're all tripping each other up in their various choreographies almost.
Yeah. I think that's a sort of perfect way to think about it.
Yeah.
And the one who would claim that he's doing that the best is Alceste.
Right. Cause he's saying there's no artifice. And yet,
and
yeah,
he's all artifice.
He's all artifice.
There's the one who claims he's the most honest and self-knowing is the one who is the most self-unknowing, because he doesn't even realize that his move will destroy him.
Mm-hmm.
Every move he makes will destroy him. If he ended up with Célimène, that would destroy him. If he ended up outside of society, that would crush him utterly, because all he must be is the objection to society.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing there. It's almost like the only one without interiority is the one who claims so hard that he is the most interior being. The one who is railing so much against what society wants, man, is the one who has capitulated utterly to society.
Yeah.
You know, it's this weird backwardsness in the play that I've been trying to think through. And that's why I thought Matt's intervention in terms of meta-theatricality was so worthwhile, because it seems to be absolutely playing with these ideas of what is the real character, what is the real me. The real me is the social role that I play,
mm-hmm.
and the interiority is just an illusion that I tell myself is there. That seems to be what's... or at least that seems to be what I'm finding at stake in The Misanthrope, that was lurking in some ways in Tartuffe, mm-hmm. but I think is front and center in The Misanthrope, and it can't be resolved because these issues can never be resolved.
Yeah.
It's a constant negotiation between your own desires and social desires, and you need to capitulate to society, man, because you have to eat.
Right.
At the same time, you're really, really angry that there's
constant compromise to be had.
Yeah.
It's the curse of being a social ape. That's where it boils down. If we were all like tigers, if we could all make our own way as solitary beings out there, except for like mating, I suppose, it would all be different. But here we are. We're social apes. It's that constant negotiation, you know, and I think honestly it shows some Alcestian integrity on Molière's part that he leaves the play so unresolved. And it's like, look, here's my honesty. Here it is. I'm standing in my truth.
Yeah. That's where I ended up with that play.
Yeah.
That's sort of where I ended up. And I that's the best I can do with it at the moment.
Yeah.
I do have to say, as far as the reading goes, this was a whole lot more fun than the Paradiso.
Oh, very much so. And I guess we should say we were reading the, which I guess is kind of the standard, the Richard Wilbur translating Molière. And it's a little bit, it took a little bit to get into because it ends up being very sing-songy.
Yeah.
And that's attempting to retain the verse aspect of the French. But anytime, I mean, it's just, guys, anytime that you're translating something that was in verse in another language into another language, I honestly, my hat is off to any translator who attempts that, because I just, you know, creating something with meter out of something that was written in a language with, you know, completely different rhythm and rhyme schemes and whatnot, you know, it's sometimes it does sound a little awkward, but honestly, like, even for all like the sing-songiness, there's a lot of like rhyming couplets and such. There are moments of real poetry. to sort of undercut
myself.
Gee,
you think?
Yeah.
No, Richard Wilbur is a very good poet. He's kind of an overlooked 20th century poet.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably mostly known for his translations, but what was sort of fascinating about him was the 20th century poetry, or I guess post 1950 20th century poetry, whatever you want to call postmodern, or what I'll call postmodern as just as a temporal marker. Mm-hmm. It was after the sort of high watermark of high modernism. Wilbur was one of a group of poets and that came of age under the aegis of high modernism, particularly high modernism as it was interpreted by the academy in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So you inherited this idea that poetry must be abstract, it must be impersonal, it must be formal. And then the narrative is tons of poets broke from that into informal, not conservative, radical, leftist, personal, free verse writing. That model doesn't hold if you actually look at the poetry written.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that the model doesn't hold is because of Richard Wilbur, who was a formalist. I mean, throughout his whole career, he's still alive as of this recording, but he's rather old, but he was a formalist throughout his whole career. And yet he was more on the fairly radical end of things. If I remember correctly, he had an FBI file on him.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He was anti-Vietnam, pro-civil rights. He was along for the ride for all of the good causes of the later 20th century. And, His verse remained formal. So anyway, he's sort of an overlooked poet, I think, because of the formality of his verse in some ways. But he manages to translate this, I think you're right, with a sense of fun.
Mm-hmm.
These are couplets, and couplets have a tendency to sound Dr. Seuss-y.
Yeah, it's verged, like, I think at first I was thinking, like, well, if this is just going to be a bunch of, like, Mother Goose rhymes, I don't know how much more I can take of it. But once you really do get into the – I think Mr. Wilbur had a very keen sense for the rhythms of the exchanges, especially. Like, when there are when line breaks occur between lines of dialogue with two different characters, it retains the rhythm very well. And that was so much, it feels like that was so much of the fun that Molière was having by having characters talk back and forth, completing each other's rhymes, you know.
That's it. And there's also that sense of speed.
Mm-hmm.
Like the couplet, was it William Butler Yeats who said that the couplet is like opening up a thought and then clicking it shut?
Yes, that was William Butler Yeats. I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm botching the line, but it's something like opening up a thought and clicking it shut. That it raises something and then conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
It raises something and then elegant conclusion. And I think Wilbur manages to capture that and capture the speed of moving through that.
Mm-hmm.
Like these weren't a slog. You can read a Molière play sort of in an afternoon, and you've got it, you know. And this didn't require copious footnotes,
right? Right. And but it, I mean, you know, it would. It, And that was kind of the interesting thing about the plays is that the, you know, it certainly helps to locate a lot of the kind of a lot of the jokes, honestly. It helps, you know, if you have some more context about like the times and society that, you know, these characters are in, it sort of helps you sort of comprehend the what the conflicts are, why people are interacting in this particular way or that. But even completely devoid of that, it still is entirely legible. Like, you can sit down and read it, and despite, of course, you know, I mean, a bit of the morals are a little old-fashioned. Like, we don't have fathers signing marriage contracts for their daughters as much anymore. But at the same time, like, you know, you could really, you know, you could not know much of anything about 17th century France, plop down in the middle of one of these plays, and yeah, you pick it up. I mean, it's really, and I think that speaks to the strength of sort of the realization of characters that Molière has, and also I think to the translation that Mr. Wilbur has generated for us.
Yeah, so I guess that sort of brings us to our conclusion. Would you recommend this?
I absolutely would. I think Molière is a hoot, and I'd only ever, you know, my first encounter with Molière, I had sort of heard of him before, but never like read any until a couple of years ago. I subscribed to the stupendous periodical Lapham's Quarterly. And if you are like me and you are like a magpie for little historical tidbits, get yourself a subscription to Lapham's. It's awesome. It's a whole magazine, a quarterly magazine of excerpts of historical documents in literature or whatever from all over the world and all through time. It's a spectacular, like, and they're based around themes. Like, oh, like a theme might be the ocean or something, and it'll be like a Chinese poem about the ocean, Jacques Cousteau talking about inventing the aqualung. It's a great magazine. But anyway, there was one that I think the theme may even have been comedy, and it was a scene from Molière's play The Doctor. And I don't remember much about it except that, like, I was just kind of leafing through it on a Sunday afternoon and cracking up. I mean, I was, like, cracking up and, like, calling my wife over to, like, read out jokes to her. And I was like, this is tremendous. Yeah. I should read more of this guy. And then I didn't. But until this time. But, yeah, I would absolutely, like, it's seriously, I actually, the recordings that I listened to were from a project called LA Theater Works. And I acquired them via the public library streaming media service called Hoopla, H-O-O-P-L-A. Check and see if your local library is a Hoopla subscriber. You should find them there. Otherwise, you can honestly, like, I think you can find, like, PDFs and stuff online. Again, go to your local library. But, yeah, I mean, like Claude was saying, like, you just sit down, have a nice cup of coffee on a Sunday morning, you know, at a free afternoon, and you'll get to read a delightful play with a lot of zingers, a bit of pathos, a bit of interesting character work. You identify with them a little bit, and you'll be done in time for your second tea.
Yeah, I was annoying the hell out of my wife by speaking in couplets for an afternoon, which is what happens from time to time. But yeah, this was a lot of fun to read, especially coming off of Dante, where I felt like
it's some heavy lifting.
Sort of, yeah, and just moving on to this, I think this was a good spot of fun. Well, speaking of heavy lifting, okay, here's what we're gonna attempt to do. We're going to attempt to read Montaigne's whole book. Next up is going to be us doing as close to a deep dive as possible as we can into the writings of Montaigne. We are both very busy fathers. So to give us a little bit of time and a head start, we're going to begin by talking to Matt Shiflett again. He's the friend of mine who's a scholar and a Francophile who gave us our brief historical background on Molière. He said he would not be averse to coming back on and giving us some background information on Montaigne.
Yeah.
After that, we're going to start with book one of the essays. Following book one, we're going to do book two. Following book two, we're going to do book three. So we're going to attempt. I'm not saying we're going to complete. but we're going to attempt to read all three books of Montaigne's essays.
Yeah.
So if last year was the Dante year of my life,
we're coming up on the Montaigne year of our lives here. Yeah.
Looks like the next year is going to be the Montaigne year. So stick with us. We'll be moving through whatever wisdom Montaigne has to offer, and we'll see where we can go from there. Well, Daniel, thanks so much. It's always a blast to talk to you, and yeah. I'm glad you had as much fun with Molière as I did. And thank you so much for the historical background. That was really fascinating.
Hey, it's something I can contribute. I mean, you got all the literature smarts. I can throw in some fun facts now and then. But yeah, man, it was a blast as always. I look forward to tackling Montaigne.
All right. So with that, let's sign off.